KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Eric Deggans is talking with Dream Hampton about executive producing the Netflix documentary series Ladies First, which puts a spotlight on the key role of women in hip-hop.
It's interesting because, I mean, you point out during Ladies First that there was sanitation going on of certain kinds of things. And the first episode almost kind of feels like a primer on women and hip hop. And I'm wondering, what do you think people don't understand or didn't understand maybe before this docuseries came out about what women contributed to hip hop's genesis and its ongoing success?
I mean, I learned so much, you know. It wasn't until reading Kathy Andali's book that I even knew the story about Cindy Campbell. Like, this anniversary that we just celebrated, that marks the 50th anniversary of hip hop. It's not a completely arbitrary day. It means something. And it is the day when in the Bronx on Sedgwick Avenue, Kool Herc DJ'd a party and MCs rapped. You know, there had always been dancing. There had always been B-girls and B-boys. But in her book, God Save the Queen, she tells the story that, no, that party was actually his sister's party, Cindy Campbell. And she got her little brother to DJ. She was doing a back to school kind of fundraiser for herself to get a school wardrobe. And wow. She booked the rec room in her public housing building. And that is like what's considered the birthday or night of hip hop, right? And Cindy is completely erased from that story. And so learning that alone speaks to how not just there we were from the beginning as an audience, but Cindy now calls herself hip hop's first promoter, right? Right?
And well, she should.
Exactly. And so, you know, there are whole industries that have sprung up around this kind of organic thing that women were doing from the beginning. And obviously, I say obviously, but, you know, once you get a couple of generations away from an origin story, it gets lost. That's so easy to do, yeah. Right? To lose the thread, yeah. On something. And so Sylvia Robinson, like retelling that story, that when Syreeta Gates says we would not have an industry, like a hip hop music industry, that looks like it does if it weren't for Sylvia Robinson putting out the Sugar Hill Gang, this crossover song that, you know, irked a lot of like New York's early rappers because it was like so crossover.
Yeah.
You know? But so accessible. I can tell you as a kid living in Detroit that I totally understood every one of those lyrics.
Of course. I was in Indiana, but same thing. Same
exactly.
Thing.
It's totally accessible. And so that's Sylvia Robinson. It's not Russell Simmons. It's not Rick Rubin. It's not Puff or P. Diddy or Love or whatever he's calling himself these days. It's not Dame Dash and Jay-Z. Like the first, like, you know, business person in hip hop is Sylvia Robinson, this woman.
Yep. Yep. So I was a pop music critic at a newspaper in New Jersey in the 90s. I actually went to that Source Awards ceremony where Suge Knight accepted an award and then dissed Diddy or whatever he's calling himself. And everybody had no idea what was going to jump off. And I only say that to say that I remember a time when even giving certain rappers a negative record review could be seriously dangerous. They might come after you physically. And here you've created a docuseries where you're seriously incisive. You're talking about a lot of situations where women were erased or assaulted and naming the male rappers who did it to them. And I'm wondering, has something changed where there's room to have this kind of criticism without so much fear? Or has it changed? Or is there concern about bringing this up now and how some people might react to it?
Well, it hasn't changed for me. I named Dr. Dre when he assaulted Dee Barnes, you know, back in 1990-91. And then Dre went on, you know, with Eminem to make a record that made a joke about the fact that he assaulted Dee Barnes. If you've seen episode 3, you'll see that NWA went on MTV News and said that she should get beat down again. So in some ways, this is all in the public record, you know. So I certainly put it in the record, you know, back when I was a 20-year-old journalist. And then Eminem put it on record, you know. So that's that. Tory Lanez is currently in jail for shooting Meg Thee Stallion. So there wasn't any hesitation on naming names. I mean, a part of like being partly raised by this music, I'm old enough that I had other musical influences. The Cure, Depeche Mode, you know, Michael Jackson and Prince, right?
Of course.
I didn't grow up on a 100% hip-hop diet, but even Prince, you know, that fearlessness is what I want to get to, you know, that fearlessness that they named names. And so there was never a question of whether or not we were going to name names. And even back then, I never had a fear. And you're right. I'm not saying that it wasn't like dangerous and that there weren't actual lives lost and there weren't journalists who were assaulted. But I can't imagine doing the work that we do in fear, you know?
There you go. There you go. But besides, you know, any kind of physical danger, I remember from those days, too, a hesitancy to criticize hip hop because you didn't want to look like you were on the side of people who were using the criticisms of rap to criticize Black culture and to criticize Black people. And it also feels like maybe we're kind of past that, too. Are we past that, too? Do we feel a little freer to be honest about where the art has fallen short?
I felt that way again back in the 90s. It was such an insular conversation. It was.
I don't think you realize like how pioneering you were. Yes. Because there were a lot of people who were not that fearless back then.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what was resonant about hip hop back then in particular was how it never reached for the euphemism. It wasn't, I mean, there were metaphors, sure, and all kinds of, you know, allegorical tales, I think of Slick Rick, right? But there was also like this literalism, this naming of names that I thought was essential. And I don't think of it as a culture. I know that it's called a culture often. I was at a magazine for 18 months, The Source, that, you know, was a big part of codifying that conversation about it being a culture. I think that culture requires food, but whatever, I'll let the anthropologists have that conversation. But even as a genre of music, the fearlessness was everything to me, and the truth telling was everything to me when it could muster that, you know, when it wasn't like hiding behind its own posturing. And it was important, you know, particularly for the women who were writing about it, myself, Joan Morgan, Karen Good Marable. Back then she was Karen Good, Karen Mayo, Sheena Lester. It was always important for us to take those issues on, the posturing, the misogyny, the cartoonish misogyny often, you know, the hypocritical nature. I mean, I don't have a problem with Snoop, you know, I actually love Snoop. You know, he called me about sometime during the pandemic and asked me to do him a favor I couldn't do, but you know, we have him in there being a hypocrite. We have him, you know, giving some interview about how women shouldn't be making songs like WAP. And our editors were able, Pasha, Princess, and we had this great post team, also women. And they were able to, you know, find this clip of this song where Snoop is saying the exact same thing that Meg and Cardi are saying. And the hypocrisy is that the problem is when women say it, you know, when they have like bodily autonomy and they're in charge of the nasty.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I heard initially that it wasn't the easiest thing to find a TV outlet that would be willing to even take on this docuseries. And I was wondering, do you have any insight into whether that was true and why it might have been tough to find somebody before Netflix got involved?
You know, I'm not sure how many places I told Culture House, no, thank you. And then they came back and said, all right, we set up with Netflix. Would you please reconsider? And then I was like, okay, I'll do this.
Okay.
So I don't know what the journey was with Culture House and pitching, but I do know that Jamila at Netflix, when she first started at Netflix, her dream was to do this project. So we had a huge ally in Jamila Farwell at Netflix. And she was in our corner throughout this process, which was protracted. We began shooting during COVID. So it took 3 years instead of a year.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. One of the things that also struck me, your own career has covered so many bases and encompassed so many different kinds of journalism and storytelling. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your early roots in documentary. What initially sort of got you interested in this work? And my sense was that, you know, this was something you were looking into while you were also working as a journalist covering the industry, right?
Well, yeah, I was in film school. I came to New York to go to Tisch School of the Arts, where I was a double major in cinema studies and UGF-TV. And so my next project is actually me looking back at my archives from 93, being like embedded in that, what would known to be, it's called I Used to Love You is our working title. And so it's evidence that I've always been shooting. And that was actually for my documentary class. You know, I consider myself a filmmaker. The first thing that I did after film school was a scripted short called I Am Mali. It went to Sundance. And when it comes to documentaries, I usually find myself in the documentary space because of this activism gene that I have that I can't turn off. There's usually some story that I feel like really needs some advocacy, and documentary feels, you know, not that different than a particular kind of advocacy. And that's how I've used it. And that's how I got into the space. It's my, not so much my journalist bone or gene, but my activist gene has me doing documentaries. But it's not the only thing I want to do. I really admire the career of someone like Liz Garbus, you know, who when given a chance, really knocked it out of the park, you know, directing episodes of Handmaid's Tale and different things. And even though, you know, the industry likes to think of her until that moment as a documentary filmmaker. But the industry thinks of you as one thing until you do the other thing. And then they have to think of you that way. But as artists, we have to think of ourselves. We have to know who we are and what we want to do and just work to do that and endeavor to do that.
That makes so much sense. Dream Hampton, co-directed and executive produced Ladies First, the documentary series, is now streaming on Netflix. Dream Hampton, thank you so much for joining us on The Business.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from John Meek, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. I'll see you next week on The Business. You're tuned into KCRW during our fall pledge drive. Donate right now, you'll get a whole year of member perks, including member-exclusive events, invitations to intimate artist sessions, plus the option to send meals to those in your community when you choose the food bank in place of a mug or t-shirt. Set it up now at kcrw.com/give. If you enjoy the banter, why not throw us a tip? Any donation amount makes you a member and gets you perks. Think about it this way. You listen all the time for free. So please give.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.